Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, October 8th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Saratoga Hospital with more than 20 locations across the greater Saratoga region. People you trust, care you deserve. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Alexandra Paul of Albany Medical Center, an endovascular surgeon. She's here to discuss cerebrovascular diseases such as stroke, aneurysm, and tumors. We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Paul, your calls all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss cerebrovascular health is Dr. Alexandra Paul of the Albany Medical Center. Dr. Paul specializes in endovascular and microsurgical neurosurgery for the treatment of a variety of you guys have done this to me purposely, of cerebrovascular diseases, including aneurysms, malformations, stenosis, stroke, and brain tumors. She's a member of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, as well as the Society of Neurointerventional Surgeons. She is the author of numerous publications and co-investigator or sub-investigator of several research projects of various treatments and techniques currently being studied in the treatment of stroke and aneurysms. Dr. Paul, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you so much for having me.
A couple of questions. Question number one, what's a stroke?
A stroke happens when the brain is not getting enough oxygen, and so part of the brain can't function properly. And so patients experience symptoms related to whatever portion of the brain isn't functioning properly. So, for example, patients aren't able to speak or move one side of their body. That's typical for someone having a stroke.
Question number two, what's an aneurysm?
An aneurysm is a weak spot in the wall of the blood vessel, and it forms almost like a balloon or a weak spot in the tire. And the reason we care about aneurysms is because they could rupture, and that could cause something called the subarachnoid hemorrhage when there's bleeding in the brain.
And when that happens?
When that happens, our goal is to treat the aneurysm to prevent it from happening again, and also to help the patient medically through the next few weeks, because there can be some sequela of the aneurysm rupturing called vasospasm when the blood vessels clamp down.
Now, how long do I have to get to the hospital after I get a stroke?
So I'm very passionate about stroke care, so I'm glad you asked that question. The truth is that it varies for each person. So every person has a different amount of time that their brain would tolerate being deprived of oxygen. Mm-hmm. And that's because everyone has different, what we call collateral or other ways the blood flow can get to that part of the brain.
Are we talking minutes or hours?
So it's probably on the order of hours. We used to think it had to be under 6 hours, but there was a recent study that came out in January that showed that patients sometimes benefit from us opening that blood vessel up to 24 hours out. Wow. So we're kind of looking at longer and longer time frames.
And how do we open that vessel out?
So we open the blood vessel by putting a large catheter in the femoral artery, the big artery in the leg, and then tracing the catheter up to the blood vessels in the neck, and then putting a smaller catheter right into the blood vessels in the brain. And then we're able to deploy a stent along the clot and drag the clot out with the stent to try to reperfuse the brain.
Does the stent stay where it is, or do you bring the stent back out?
Most of the time we take the stent out. If for some reason we try a few times and the blood vessel continues to be closed off, then we could leave a stent in place.
Ah, okay. And you, of course, you can have an aneurysm anywhere in your body, right? But you specialize in the brain aneurysms.
Correct.
And that's what makes you a neurosurgeon.
Exactly.
Okay. The telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros, you're on.
Are there prime locations for aneurysms? vessels, or can they develop any place in the vascular system?
Hi, Jim. That's a great question. So aneurysms typically develop at branch points of blood vessels, so where one blood vessel splits into two, because the sheer force of the blood flowing against the wall of the blood vessel as it changes direction can cause weakening of the vessel, and that can cause an aneurysm. So there certainly are locations that are more common for aneurysms, and they're generally thought to be at bifurcations.
And is it almost always the brain which gets the most business?
So that's certainly what I'm focused on, but there are aneurysms that can happen in the aorta. So in the abdomen, you can get aneurysms as well. But the aneurysms that I'm talking about at bifurcations typically happen in the brain.
Okay, Jim, thanks a lot. Let's go to Ann in Altamont. Okay, Ann in Altamont, your turn. Go.
Hi, thank you so much. Is there any relation between a stroke or even a very, like a TIA and the development of transient global anemia? Amnesia. So I have a friend who had something like that happen, and I really don't know anything about that.
So there certainly can be a relation with stroke and memory. So the part of the brain that controls memory can certainly be involved in a stroke. And so those patients could certainly suffer memory loss. And it could be similar to transient global amnesia, where they don't remember the event at all.
But is there any, are they cousins of any kind? In other words, memory in both cases is an issue, but are they cousins in any way?
Well, I think stroke could be one cause of memory loss, but there are lots of other causes of memory loss.
Right.
But stroke could certainly be one cause.
But a TGA or a TIA, what is it?
A TIA is a transient ischemic attack where the brain doesn't have the blood flow that it needs, but it then quickly gets it back and the symptoms reverse.
I see. Okay. So thank you for that. Anne, does that answer your question?
Yeah, pretty much, but I'm kind of at a loss to know what even causes this type of amnesia, just out of the blue.
But your friend did have a TIA?
Well, we think she did, but it was not not within the week or two preceding the episode of amnesia.
And did she have any trouble with one side of her body or with her speech?
She had a little bit of numbness on her face.
On both sides of the face?
No, just on one side, apparently. And then several weeks later, this global amnesia occurred. So just seems so strange.
Yeah, that does seem unusual. Has she seen a neurologist?
Yeah, she's getting medical care.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm not sure. It sounds like an unusual case.
And thanks for the call. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Tim in Ballston Spa. All right, Tim, you're on.
Yeah, just as a quick aside, I had an ischemic stroke quite a few years ago. I was in bed and I made my coffee. I had a coffee maker at the head of the bed, and I poured the coffee with my left hand. And a little later, when I went to pick it up, I couldn't hold it. And I subsequently headed for the bathroom, and it was like my right leg would bounce off the ground. But that's not my question. And I totally recovered.
I'm glad to hear that.
I have spinal stenosis, and I hear about this laser institute or surgery on that.
You see it in the middle of the night on the television.
Do you have any feedback?
So I think, there are certainly lots of ways to do spine surgery, and there's always going to be kind of new technology that people are purporting as being better. And I think the data for laser spine surgery has yet to kind of stand out as being better than traditional spine surgery. So I think the most important thing is to see someone that you're comfortable with who has, safe results that you would be satisfied with. But I wouldn't necessarily be focused on seeing someone who does laser spine surgery.
Thank you, Tim. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Dan in Albany. Dan in Albany, your turn. Go.
Hi there. I'm not sure. I missed half of your introduction, so I'm not sure if this is an appropriate question for you, but give it a shot anyway. My mom is suffering with lymphedema, and she's got a lot of pain in her legs accompanying this. And when I spoke with a lymphedema therapist, she told me that usually it doesn't come associated with a lot of pain, and that's probably being caused by vascular inflammation. And I was wondering if you had any insights as to how to deal with vascular inflammation and maybe what different types or causes of the inflammation I might be looking for.
Okay, now, Dan, I want to warn you, we're coming up against a mandatory break in just a couple of minutes. So, doctor, if you could be brief about this, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. So, well, I'm a neurosurgeon, so I think the vascular inflammation I can speak to you as just kind of some general medical knowledge, but I think what the therapist is implying is that it's possible your mom has some nerve pain from another cause. Does she have diabetes?
No, she doesn't.
Okay. And she has swelling in the legs?
Yes.
Okay. Unfortunately,
she has good arterial flow, but poor
venous return?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Has she seen a vascular surgeon? Not a cerebrovascular, just a vascular surgeon?
Yes.
Okay. I think that would probably be her best bet. Unfortunately, I'm not too familiar with peripheral vascular disease.
Dan, as I said, I'm sorry we're out of time, but we're going to a break now, but we will be back with more and with Dr. Alexandra Paul of the Albany Medical Center. Thank you. Welcome back to the Vox Pop, everybody. We're here with a wonderful guest, Dr. Alexandra Paul of the Albany Medical Center, who specializes in endovascular and microsurgical neurosurgery for the treatment of a variety of cerebrovascular diseases, including aneurysms, malformations, stenosis, stroke, and brain tumors. Wow. So you are... You know, we always say you don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure that one out, but you are a brain surgeon. That's great. Anyway, there's one person on the phone right now, and so I'm going to take the opportunity to ask one real fast question. What are the symptoms of an aneurysm?
So ruptured aneurysms usually present with the worst headache of the patient's life.
Really?
Typically described as a thunderclap headache, or usually they'll just come in and say, this is the worst headache I've ever had. About 30% of people who have a ruptured aneurysm, however, come in unresponsive. So it can also be a cause of coma. Unruptured aneurysms, however, usually are asymptomatic.
Uh-huh.
So the majority of people don't know they have an unruptured aneurysm.
You got a time bomb waiting.
And usually they're found by screening for an unrelated issue.
For example?
They were in a car accident, so they get a scan. They're having headaches. I saw a patient today who was having dizziness. There's a large variety of reasons why patients can get scanned. And then they'll find an unruptured aneurysm.
Right. So for those of us who would rather know early, is there a way, I mean, you know, when you get tested for various diseases, you go in for something or other. You know, if you're a woman, you get a pap smear. Is there any such thing for aneurysms?
That's a really good question. It currently has not been found to be effective to screen the whole population because the incidence of aneurysms is quite low. And so generally it's felt that the risk of screening the population is not worth it. But that may change as the technology continues to improve.
So is there a genetic history here? In other words, if your parents had it, do you have a better chance of getting it?
So that's a really good question.
That's two I got.
Yes. Some aneurysms are felt to be genetic, but that is the exception rather than the rule. Most patients who have an aneurysm, either ruptured or unruptured, do not have a family history.
Yeah.
The only risk factor that we know for aneurysm formation and aneurysm rupture is smoking. But we do see plenty of patients who have aneurysms who've never smoked before. So there are other things.
What does the smoke do, Alexandra? What does the smoke do?
We don't really know, other than the fact that somehow it weakens the blood vessel wall more than normal, and those aneurysms are more likely to rupture.
Okay. We're off to David in Canaan. All right, David in Canaan, you're on.
Hi, I was wondering, is there any relationship between the buildup of plaque or narrowing of the coronary arteries with respect to narrowing of either the carotid or the cerebral arteries?
Hi, David. Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things I really want to stress today, is that the majority of strokes are preventable. And they're preventable by the same things that help prevent coronary artery disease, which are exercise, a healthy diet, treatment of diabetes. Those things that can help prevent coronary artery disease can also help prevent carotid artery disease.
Would statins have the same effect for the cerebral arteries as they do on the coronary arteries?
Yes, absolutely, as well as aspirin.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay. I just read a study that said came out and said that the 81 milligram aspirin was now somewhat in doubt. I've taken one all my life. What do you know about that?
Sure. So that study looked at patients who have no history of any heart disease. Mm-hmm. And so I think certainly most doctors would continue to recommend daily aspirin for patients who have a history of heart disease or a history of stroke. But that study specifically looked at patients who have no other risk factors, mm-hmm. and found that the risks were higher than the benefits.
And the risk is bleeding, right?
The risk is bleeding, usually GI bleeding, ulcers.
Right.
So I think a larger study still needs to be done, but it did question what we generally think is a safe medication for patients who have no risk factors.
Right. They always pull the rug out from under me. I don't like that. Okay, so it's 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Maurice in Bennington. Hi, Maurice.
Well, good afternoon, folks. Dr. Chartok, one of my heroes, I'm telling you. Listen, thanks for taking my call. I've been living with an abdominal aneurysm for about 10 years. And, doctor, I know this is not the area of your expertise, but I think you could probably answer my question. It's been at 4 centimeters. It stays there. I get it monitored with an ultrasound every 6 months, blah, 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 blah. If surgery became necessary, what would be the nature of that surgery? In other words, the people at the Albany Vascular Group are saying if it's at 4, you know, let's not do anything. If it grows, then we'll do something. So what kind of surgery would it be?
What would they do?
Hi, Maurice. My understanding is that the surgery is similar to the procedures that I do in the brain, meaning it's an endovascular procedure, and they're able to put a catheter in the blood vessel, the big blood vessel in the leg, and then put another catheter up to where this aneurysm is. And then they are able to lay a stent in the aorta to help reconstruct the normal size of the blood vessel.
Is that microsurgery of any nature or regular big cut and blah, blah, blah?
It would be considered endovascular surgery. It would be done under X-ray guidance, and it would be done inside the blood vessels.
Ah, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Good luck. I hope it stays stable.
Maurice?
Well, you know, my goal is to die with this thing the way it is. What the hell?
Yeah, die with it, but not
right,
because of it. Thank you,
job.
Maurice. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, and now on to Jim in Mechanicville. All right, Jim in Mechanicville, you're on.
It's me. You were speaking just a few minutes ago about screening for aneurysms.
We
and
were.
How they're they haven't yet been shown to be a there hasn't yet been shown to be a great need for that. However, and you're probably aware of this, there's a company that does screenings called Lifeline Screenings.
Yes.
And I have had, I have gone through their screening. I just went through it back in June. And one of the things that they actually do is for, is abdominal aneurysms. So I was just wondering if you could speak to the value of you know, that type of thing. Because it isn't covered by insurance. And but, you know, their whole shtick is to, you know, do screenings for things that have health impacts, but that are not necessarily covered by insurance.
Okay, here we go. Jim, thank you for that question. Go ahead, Doc.
So, sure. Screening for abdominal aneurysms is certainly easier because it's just an ultrasound test, which is certainly more affordable. So that is something that I think is becoming more popular. But the MRA or the CTA that would be required to screen for intracranial aneurysms is much more expensive. And the CTA does carry a small risk of radiation as well as IV contrast administration. And so I think until we're able to have a better technology, we are working on ultrasounds for the brain, which maybe someday would be able to screen for aneurysms. I think it's still going to remain in question.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, now we're going to William in Albany. William in Albany, you're on.
Thank you. Back in the early 90s, I started getting a very bad facial spasm, and I was living in New York City at the time. And my neurologist sent me to Dr. Peter Janetta in Pittsburgh, who performed a microvascular decompression surgery where he placed a small piece of material between the blood vessel and the nerve that was causing my face to spasm. So two questions. The life, that was 22 years ago now, the life expectancy of that Teflon or whatever it was maybe 10 to 15 years. I don't have the spasm now. So the question is, one, is if you know anything about that, and two, is that blood vessel, is there a potentiality that that blood vessel may be susceptible to an aneurysm, given, you know, its weakness and hence the reason for the surgery?
Sure. So I'm glad you're still doing well from that surgery. It is a surgery that I'm familiar with. And we do see a lot of patients who only need to have that done one time. So I think there is a good chance that if you've gone this long without your symptoms recurring, you'll be, you know, in the clear in terms of needing to have the surgery repeated. Even if the Teflon disintegrates, there is some scar tissue that would form there that would prevent the blood vessel from irritating that nerve. So I certainly don't think that just because it's been 10 years, you're going to have the pain come back. And then in terms of an aneurysm developing there, we've never seen that. Usually the blood vessel is protected by that Teflon and there's no weak spot or damage to the blood vessel.
Thank you, William. Okay, and now on to Melissa in Woodstock. Okay, Melissa, you're on.
Hi, this is Melissa.
Yep. Hi, Melissa.
About a year ago, it was discovered I had a subclavian stele.
Okay.
And from what I understand, that's not common.
Correct.
And a stent was put in, and I feel much better. Things are much better. But I went for many years, at least 3 to 4 years, without knowing I had this happening. And now that I'm recovered, I'm still left with some vertigo and stressors like being like humid, heat as a stress. If I exercise and get really heated up, I feel vertigo. So I'm wondering, can there be can that be connected to the subclavian stele? I guess that's what I'm asking.
And Doc, could you give us the name of that condition again?
Sure. So subclavian stele is a condition where it's basically steel. The arm is stealing the blood that should be going to the brain because there's some stenosis in the subclavian artery. And so the arm is trying to get perfusion, and it's taking that blood away from the vertebral artery, which goes to the brain.
That's very clear. Now, stenosis in this case, I know what it is in a back. What is it in this case?
So stenosis here is just narrowing of the blood vessel.
I see.
Usually due to plaque.
Okay.
And so are these the same symptoms you were having before you had the stent put in, Melissa?
But milder, you know, and not as often.
Sure.
But it seems to be centered around, like I said, around heat and my body being stressed with a humid, hot day or with exercise.
And are you taking any aspirin?
I am, and I'm under treatment, and I did go to my neurologist.
Okay.
And my carotids look okay. There is some plaque in there.
Have you had any follow-up for the stent, any imaging to make sure the stent is open?
Yes, exactly. Yes, they were very diligent about that. I went back many times. So the care and the treatment for actually putting the stent in was fine.
Right.
But because I'm still experiencing some vertigo and fatigue from those stressors, I'm wondering, can that be related to any permanent damage that the subclavian stele did to my brain?
I think that's unlikely if it's coming and going. So if it were permanent, mm-hmm. I would certainly say that
I
would be
see.
Possible. But if it's something that is resolving and then comes on again, that is usually would not be any sort of permanent brain damage, but it does suggest that maybe for whatever reason the vertebral artery is still not getting enough blood flow.
The telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. Melissa mentioned the word stressor. My job here is when I hear a word that I don't think everybody understands, what does she mean by stressor?
So I think she means a trigger or something that is occurring to bring out her symptoms.
I see.
That's correct.
And in this case, the stressor would be, Melissa?
Like the hot, humid, odd days that we get, muggy days.
That would be a stressor.
Yeah. I have to be in air conditioning, for example.
Me too. Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it a lot. All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now over to Jason in East Greenbush. Okay, Jason, your turn.
Earlier in the show, the doctor mentioned that cigarette smoking could be a risk factor for aneurysms. Can cocaine use also be a risk factor?
Absolutely. So cocaine use is definitely something that we see in younger patients who come in with ruptured aneurysms. Very frequently, they do have a positive drug history.
What's the relationship?
So the thought is that cocaine elevates your blood pressure quite significantly, and that blood pressure increases the shear forces on the blood vessels. So thank you for mentioning that. Cocaine is certainly a risk factor for not just aneurysms, but lots of problems with the blood vessels in the brain.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Okay. We got lots of room here. You want to call up now? I would advise you to do it if you got a question. Got one more person holding on, and after that, it would be yours. So now we're going to go to Ralph in Greenfield. Ralph in Greenfield, you're on.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because in March I had my third stroke. I'm doing okay with them as far as it goes. The first stroke quite a while ago resulted in partial paralysis on my right side. I got through that. The second stroke resulted in hemianopsis, which is a right side hemianopsis, loss of vision in the right side of each eye. So my right eye works, my left eye works, but not the right side of either eye. The third stroke gave me a few additional blind spots and affected my balance centers, apparently. I've had ultrasounds, including intrathoracic ultrasound, carotid ultrasounds, brachial arteries look good, femoral arteries look good. I have a PFO in my heart, a patent foramen ovale, which is apparently, the thought is that it may be blowing chunks and that may be where the strokes are coming from. The question is, why are these strokes going up the tiny little arteries to my vision center rather than up my carotid arteries and doing more damage? Not that I'm complaining. And also, does the doctor have any thoughts on closing of PFOs? I understand that there's some risk involved. There's no definite link to my strokes. So what are her thoughts on that?
Okay, Ralph, we'll get an answer for you. Go ahead, Doc.
So a couple questions here. It sounds like you've had a few small strokes on very different parts of the brain, which can be common for patients who have a patent foramen ovale. And your question is, why is the clot not building up in your carotid artery but going more distally into the brain?
No. If the clots are forming in my left atrium, then why are those clots not going up my carotid arteries? Why are they branching off into my brachial arteries, which look clear by the ultrasounds, and going up the tiny little arteries that serve the vision center in the back of my brain?
So were all of your strokes in the posterior fossa or in the...
Well, the first stroke was undiagnosed. I knew when it happened. I didn't know when it happened that it was a stroke, but by the next day it was obvious that it had been a stroke. It was incredibly painful. I imagined it had to be hemorrhagic because of that, since occlusive strokes are generally painless. But that was different. That was many years back. And within the last 2 years, I've had two strokes which are affecting my vision center.
Well, it sounds like the clot could also be going into the subclavian artery to the vertebral artery. which would not necessarily be to the brachial artery. But the clot will basically go until it reaches a wedge point where it can't go any further. So that's why it's getting stuck in the small vessels instead of getting stuck in the carotid artery or the vertebral artery.
Okay, thank you, Ralph. We're going to have to take a break now. But June and Bob and Eleanor and Donna, stay tuned because we're going to get to you next. We'll be right back. And we are back with our wonderful guest, Dr. Alexandra Paul of Albany Medical Center, who is here to discuss cerebrovascular health. And we're getting a lot of calls, and we'll try to get to everybody now. All right. Let's go to, Bob in a car. Let's hope the car hasn't gone too far. Bob, you're on.
Hi, doctor.
Hello, Bob.
Okay. The question I have for my mother was 75 years old and had a stroke, a bleeding stroke. But for many, many years, because she had arthritis, she took aspirin almost every 4 hours. Mm. Now, I have a grandson in medical school, and I mentioned that she had a bleeding stroke. And he said, well, that can be hereditary. Now, would it be more likely in her case to be for all the aspirin she took? Or is it something I should be concerned about?
So generally, bleeding kinds of strokes, which are not related to aneurysms, which I assume hers wasn't because there was no mention of an aneurysm, have to do with high blood pressure. And so while the aspirin could have potentially made the bleeding worse, the stroke itself was likely caused by high blood pressure. So if you have normal blood pressure and she did not have any aneurysms, then I don't think there's anything you need to be screened for.
Okay, so you're saying that basically you don't think the aspirin caused her stroke.
Correct.
So you're saying.
Correct.
Thank you, Bob. All right, now we're going to go over to June in Kingston. All right, June in Kingston, you're on.
Hi, doctors. I just had a question. I was wondering, I suffer from migraines, and I wanted to know, I take sumatriptan for it, and it's, as far as I know, it's a vasoconstrictor. And I wanted to know, does that put you at a higher risk for a stroke?
Hi, June. So sumatriptan has been related to some cases of stroke. So I think if it is helping you with your migraines, it's certainly fine to continue. But it is something to be aware of and to try to reduce any other risk factors that you have for stroke. So to continue to exercise and to eat a healthy diet and to not smoke. And to just be aware that there is some small association between the triptans and smoking and stroke.
Oh, okay, great. And should I do regular screening? Is that something that you would do?
So it wouldn't be for aneurysm. It would be for stroke. And there's really no screening that you could do to look at the triptan with stroke.
Okay, June, thank you. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Let's go to Eleanor in Lenox. All right. Eleanor in Lenox, go.
Hello, this is Eleanor. It's so nice to talk with you both, doctors.
Hi, Eleanor.
I have had a rupture of a aneurysm in 1979 and was treated at Albany Med very successfully.
That's great.
I wondered if an exposure to, even though I wasn't smoking, whether it was the secondhand smoke that can also cause aneurysms.
Yeah, I think that's certainly possible. No one has ever been able to study that, but there's no reason why, you know, we've seen secondhand smoke cause a lot of other systemic diseases. And so I think there's no reason why it could also not be partially responsible for problems with aneurysms as well.
So, Eleanor, did you spend a lot of time around a smoker of any kind?
Yes, unfortunately, a very heavy smoker that my husband was a very heavy smoker. And I also had an exposure to carbon monoxide poisoning perhaps about 3 or 4 years previous to that, as well as my entire family.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad you recovered so well.
Okay, Eleanor, thank you for your call. All right, now we're going to go to Donna in Malta. All right, Donna in Malta, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question in regards to my husband had a stroke
3 years ago in the hippocampus area of his brain, and they had a very hard time finding it. And he suffered from global amnesia for 48 hours and then recovered. And he's had a follow-up with neurology and a cardiologist who had ruled out atrial fib and any other causes for the stroke, like high blood pressure. So, but he's getting forgetful again, and I'm wondering, could that have damaged that part of his brain, or should we be doing some other test? Is there surgery for that part of the brain? Just any ideas that would help me direct the care that he might need at this time.
You feel like he's progressively getting worse?
I feel like his memory, he's starting to have memory loss, and it sort of reminds me of the same episodes he had right when he was going through this stroke. I mean, it's kind of like the same questions. He can't remember certain things. It's not profuse, but it's everyday little things. And I also know that Alzheimer's, I guess, hits the hippocampus initially first.
I think it sounds reasonable.
So it could be a number of things.
Okay,
but
Donna, let's let the doc have a chance here. Go ahead, doc.
Okay.
It sounds like it would be reasonable to get a new MRI of the brain. And if he did have any areas of new stroke, to get some imaging of the blood vessels. And that's where a potential surgery could come into place. If there's any narrowing of the blood vessels that is putting him at risk for stroke, then we could possibly do a procedure to try to balloon open those blood vessels.
Okay, Donna.
Okay, so would he see a neurologist for that?
So I think seeing his neurologist to start would be a good place to start, to get the MRI. And then they could refer to a neurosurgeon if needed.
How are you guys getting along these days, the neurosurgeons and the...
Very well.
Better. I mean, there's been an improvement over the years.
Oh, great. Well, that helps tremendously.
All right. Good luck, Donna.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I remember the neurosurgeons used to say that the rap on the other guys were, diagnose and adios. But now I think everybody's getting along better. Yeah. That's good. And now over to Peter in Bennington. Peter in Bennington, you're on.
Hi, I've been diagnosed with glossopharyngeal neuralgia.
Okay.
And presently taking carbamazepine because the attacks, as you know, are very painful.
Sure.
I've been told I could have surgery to put Teflon between the nerves and the blood vessels.
Sure.
That are causing this, but of course this scares me, and just kind of want to know what you know about the surgery and...
Sure. Were you listening earlier when the guy called in who had previously had a microvascular decompression?
What's that, ma'am?
Someone had previously called in who had a microvascular decompression. I didn't know if you were listening then, but it is a surgery that I'm very familiar with. It's a surgery where we remove part of the skull and we pull aside the cerebellum, or the bottom part of the brain, and we find the blood vessel that is impinging on the nerve, and we insert a small piece of cotton between the nerve and the blood vessel. And the success rates are usually very good. And so for patients who are having debilitating pain, which is keeping them from eating or from kind of living their daily life, we generally recommend that they undergo the surgery. There are some risks. There's a risk you could have facial weakness. There's a risk you could have a spinal fluid leak or infection. But these risks are generally small, and patients are usually quite satisfied with the outcome after the surgery.
And what happens to that piece of the skull that you've taken away?
So usually in this part of the brain, which is the back part of the brain, we usually cover it with a piece of mesh and some cement.
Wow. Okay, Peter, thank you very much. All right, and now over to, let's see here, David in Rhinebeck. The telephone number is 1-800-348-2551. David in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Yes, I have a question. When I get up and wake up in the morning, I have it's not a headache. It's like my whole head is just like pounding inside, not sharp, just dull. And it sticks with me for a couple of hours. And if I take a Tylenol, it might go away a little bit faster. But during the day, I don't have that. And I was wondering if that's something I should have looked at right away, or I have a doctor's appointment at the VA in next month. So Could you help me with that?
Sure. How long has it been going on?
Oh, a year.
And do you take any other medications in the morning, any blood pressure medications?
I do. I take, yes, I do.
So my suspicion is that you're waking up and your head may hurt because your blood pressure is high, and then you take your blood pressure medication and your blood pressure comes down and your head pain goes away.
Oh.
Do you have a way to take your blood pressure at home?
Yes, I do.
Have you ever tried taking it when you have the headache?
No.
Maybe give that a try tomorrow.
Hey, Doc, is your blood pressure higher in the morning than it is the rest of the day?
Well, if you take medication, certainly, because the medication hasn't kicked in yet. But in general, no.
Yeah, I usually take it like after breakfast in the morning. So
that's my guess. Maybe try to take it earlier or, you know, see what your blood pressure is before you take the medication.
I'll check it. I'll check it when I wake up.
All right. Very good. Good luck.
Good idea.
Bye-bye. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. And we go to Marty in Otis. All right. Marty, you're in Otis. Go.
Hi, doctor. I have a two-part question. The first one is that I had a carotid scan done recently, and the doctor that ordered it said everything looks good. My regular, he's an interventional cardiologist because they do have six stents and an ICD and secondary heart block bradycardia. And so he said everything looks good. My regular cardiologist that I go to every 3 months wants to do a CAT scan of the neck on the side where the velocity is 238. And I don't know which way to go. The other thing is I went from taking Effient 10 milligrams from the brand name to the generic. And then after a couple of weeks of the generic, I started getting bruising, much worse. I wasn't getting a lot of bruising at all before. And so the insurance won't cover it, and the cost differential is crazy. So what happened is that he halved it to 5 milligrams. So it went from 39 before, which was too low, to 158 now, which is too high. And I don't know if he's sure as to how to proceed to get that to the what he calls a sweet spot of maybe like 110, 120.
Okay, so for the first question, I think you're saying that you had an ultrasound of your carotid arteries and the velocity on one side was 238. So
yes.
That I would generally consider to be quite high. And so I do think it would be reasonable to have the CTA of your neck done to evaluate for any stenosis.
Okay.
And then the second question is about the Effient. And I think you're talking about, the numbers you're talking about are the platelet reactivity unit, which
P2
measures...
P2Y12.
Exactly, yeah. So that measures how well your body's responding to the Effient. And like you've mentioned, you know, we see a very big swing in the numbers. And what your lowest number was in the 30s and your highest
39,
was...
39. And then that happened, I don't know what it was before because it was never done, but after I went on generic, I started getting... bruising in my arms, my stomach, my hands and stuff. And so he halved it to the 5 milligram Effient. And 2 weeks later,
right.
It was 158. I don't know when
you could
39.
Try maybe 7.5 milligrams, try a 5 and then half of a 5. That might help you get to the right spot.
Okay.
I don't know if they're splittable. Is it possible to do a 10 one day and a 5 the next or something like that?
Yeah, sometimes we have patients take it just 2 days a week, you know, so you could certainly propose that to your doctor.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks
All right.
a lot.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Good luck.
Okay, I want to read you two that came in over the internet. My grandmother turned 90 yesterday, had a stroke a few months ago. The effects overall have subsided, but she's still having trouble swallowing. We have taken her to the ENT and ruled out any issue with the throat itself. The ENT believes the issue with swallowing may have been caused by the stroke. What type of things can be done to help with swallowing?
So the best thing is definitely to continue to work with a speech therapist, and they can help the body relearn how to swallow after a stroke.
And here's another one. Which we already did. Roxanne wanted us to talk a bit about transient global amnesia. We did talk about that earlier. So you can, by the way, folks, you can always go online and get this Medical Monday and listen to it again, because that answer is there. My two siblings and I have each had more than one episode. Thank you. Any reaction?
Nope, other than, you know, certain parts. Memory is very complex. There are multiple parts of the brain that control memory.
Okay.
And it's something that we're still studying.
Okay, we're sort of running out of time. We can take one or two more. We'll go to John in Hyde Park. John in Hyde Park, you're on.
Yes, doctors, hi, thanks for listening. I just had an aneurysm repaired at Albany Medical Center as of last week, as a matter of fact. Very nice treatment there, by the way. And my question is, okay, so they put a stent in it to alleviate a swollen blood vessel. What is the success rate on that? And the second question is, should my kids be checked? Is this hereditary?
So this is an aneurysm in the brain?
Yes.
Okay, so sometimes we use stents if the aneurysms have a wide opening, and that helps us reconstruct the normal blood vessel. And we can allow, I'm not sure if you had coils also put in, but sometimes they help hold the coils in. And the longevity with stenting is better. The treatment outcome is better, and the likelihood of recurrence is lower with stenting. In terms of your children, the official recommendations are if you have any two first-degree relatives with aneurysms, then you should be screened. So a first-degree relative would be a parent or a sibling. So if you're the only one with an aneurysm and your children are not smokers, the official recommendation is that they don't need to be screened.
Okay, thank you for that. And now we're almost running out of time. Let's go to Joe in Great Barrington. Joe, you got 1 second to ask your question. Go ahead.
I'm a little concerned about the new guidelines for blood pressure control. And an elderly person, what do you consider to be normal? I mean, try to achieve 120 over 80 in a 70-year-old, sometimes it can be very challenging. And how do you handle that with your patients when elderly patients have stiffer vessels?
Good question. Okay.
Yeah, doctor. I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Some patients certainly develop symptoms of hypotension if they're brought below 130. And so I think those patients, it's okay to keep them at 140. I think the point of those guidelines is really that kind of for the younger generation, the best thing is for them to be below 120. So again, it's a case-by-case basis.
So how come if somebody starts with 140 in the morning, mm-hmm. and by the afternoon they're at, 110? What does that change represent?
It probably has to do with change in stress hormones that can affect the blood pressure. Uh-huh. But any period
driving
of time,
Albany, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Any period of time at an elevated blood pressure can put you at risk for having problems.
Great question there, Joe. All right, Charlie, we're going to give you the last chance, and I think we're almost out of time. Go ahead, Charlie. Got to be fast.
Hi, good afternoon. I currently have three unruptured aneurysms, and the locations I was curious about if there would be any way to intervene if necessary. They're 1 to 2 millimeters. One is a right carotid terminus. One is on the supraclinoid right internal carotid. And then one that they're not sure if it's on the basal artery, a blister aneurysm or infundibulum.
Okay, Charlie, you got to stop. Charlie, got to stop right there. We're almost out of time. Go ahead, Doc.
So the good news is those aneurysms all sound quite small. So 1 millimeter aneurysms we generally don't treat because the risk of treating outweighs the benefit. So generally for a 1 millimeter aneurysm, the risk is probably less than 1 in 1,000 of rupture, and the risk of any kind of surgical procedure would be higher.
We are out of time. Thank you, Charlie. My apologies to no one because nobody got left on the time. I want to thank Dr. Alexandra Paul of Albany Medical Center for being with us today. You were terrific, Alexandra. Thank you.
Thank
so
you
much
for having
for
me.
Doing it. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy, who has been at this radio station for so long. Thanks to Joe McElwick for answering the phones. Our producers, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.